Thank you for downloading One to One from BBC Radio 4.
Woody Allen famously said, "I'm not scared of dying, I just don't want to be there when it happens." Until recently, I'd have gone further and said, "I don't want to be there when it happens to anyone, or 5 years either side of that event." But last Christmas, on Christmas Day, my mum died. She taught me to like broccoli, she taught me Yiddish sayings like, "You can't dance at two weddings with one behind." And now she's teaching me to think about mortality. Despite suffering from severe Alzheimer's, it seemed to me that she'd managed to take the decision to allow herself to die. So is that possible? Can someone with a terminal illness, even with Alzheimer's, still have control over the moment they die? And is it possible to not be terrified of death? I'm told it's definitely going to happen to me, apparently. So how can I prepare for it? And how do you talk to loved ones, in fact anyone who's gravely ill and dying? What do you say? To try and help me make sense of this, next week I'm talking to the writer Jenny Diskey, who's been writing and tweeting incredibly eloquently about her terminal illness. But first I'm talking to Catherine Mannix, a consultant in palliative medicine, who's seen between 12 and 14,000 people die, and only with about six of them has she thought, "This is awful." Catherine, thanks for talking to me about this. If we could start by talking about my mother, which is a thing that I've been doing all my life. She was very ill with Alzheimer's, but was okay as long as she was mobile. She then had a fall and was confined to a wheelchair. And within 6 weeks, it was as if she'd made the decision, "No, I don't want this." She stopped eating. And now I feel that it was that she took control and said, I don't want to be around in this situation. Is it possible that people can take control, even very ill people?
I think that most people who have experience in palliative care and end-of-life care would say we feel that it is likely that there is some degree of control. Mm-hmm. People who we think are probably within days of dying sometimes don't die as soon as we had thought they were going to, if there's an important event to hang on for. So they'll wait for the phone call that says that the grandchild has been safely delivered.
Yes.
Or they'll wait for the relative who's travelling around the world to be at the bedside. And this person will be apparently often deeply unconscious. And yet there's a moment perhaps of letting go with the relief that everything is safe now and I can do that. Another pattern that we recognise is families who are very, very attentive to somebody while they're dying. There's a vigil around the bed. There's never a moment when there isn't somebody with the dying person. And then something happens and the person on vigil goes to the toilet, gets called to the telephone, and in those few moments, that person dies. And it happens with ridiculous regularity, to the extent that actually we talk to families about the possibility that this can happen. And we don't really understand what it's about. Is it that actually having somebody in the room with you, talking to you, maintains a little bit of stimulation of your brain so that last little light bulb doesn't quite go out? Or is it something much more subtle than that? Is it something about those ties of love, of actually relaxing into that last breath when there's nobody around to just watch and be distressed? Is it some kind of gift that people are making?
Why aren't we told this? Why aren't we... It could be so reassuring, could it not, that to know this element of control?
Well, I think so. I think that actually the more we know about what dying is like, the less frightened we're going to be about it happening to people that we love and ultimately to ourselves. So in 30 years of working with people who are dying, I have only become less and less afraid about what dying will be like for myself and for the people who I love.
And what sort of things have helped? What would be the things that you would say if there was a guide to dying well?
That there's a definite pattern of events that happens around dying, which is a little bit like the sort of pattern that we understand about pregnancy and labour and delivery of a baby. You know, there's a kind of sequence of things that almost always happens and usually happens in a particular order, more or less. And a good midwife who's in attendance on that doesn't need to get in the way. It'll happen and it'll be okay. So the first thing is having an illness that is developing to the extent that it's now starting to threaten your life. And those sorts of illnesses tend to make us be more tired. So over time, over the kind of early part of dying, what people notice is that they just don't have as much energy anymore and that they need sleep as much as they need food and drink in order to feel well and have energy to do things. And as time goes by, we find that people are sleeping more and awake less. And I think that probably is something that you saw happen to your mum over those last few weeks of her life, that she would be more tired.
Yes.
Until at the very end of somebody's life, they are simply asleep and dipping in and out of unconsciousness and then eventually completely unconscious all the time.
So you're saying that often it's they have slipped into unconsciousness before the moment of death.
Right. But it won't have felt like going to sleep. It won't have felt like a fading away. They won't have noticed it happening. Now, sometimes people have been told that they won't be awake when they die, and that's it. They're on meerkat mode forever after. I'm not going to go to sleep, because if I go to sleep, I might die while I'm asleep.
Okay.
It doesn't happen like that. So there's this process that allows us to be less and less aware and to not be particularly aware at the moment of those last few breaths.
So generally before death there is this state of unconsciousness. And yet sometimes they can perceive things like an affectionate command saying you can go now.
Yeah.
And do you tell the dying person this process is going to happen?
I do.
And do you think that's key to helping them die well?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question. So I've probably had that conversation with people, hundreds of times. I haven't had anybody be more distressed at the end of the conversation than they were when we started the conversation. Sometimes the conversation is started because somebody is distressed and fearful and dying is very close. And actually this is the conversation that enables them to just relax and stop being on constant alert and being terrified mode. But usually what's kinder, I feel, is to be able to have that conversation where we're still talking about the month's life expectancy thing. Because as time goes by and they start to notice their energy battery changing in the way that we've discussed and realise that that description turns out to work for them, it gives them more confidence that the other things that we've said about what the very end of life will be like will also be accurate for them.
Right, right. I mean, it's interesting as you're saying that, I'm just aware that I'm going, how can people be calm about approaching death? We don't know what death is. It's nothing. I won't be able to do anything. Or it might be perchance to dream, you know. It might be hell. How can people be calm about that?
It's fascinating, isn't it? And I'm full of admiration for people because they are.
It feels very reassuring to hear that description. I mean, I'm still, because I am, thank God, healthy, I'm still going, no, kicking and screaming, I just can't imagine. I presume there are people who resist.
There are. And that's interesting in itself, because very often they resist by deciding that it actually isn't happening. And I remember looking after a girl who was about the same age as me when we were both in our early 30s. And I'd looked after her in the cancer centre, and subsequently I was working in the hospice where she came when she was terminally ill. And 20 minutes before she died, she was sitting on the edge of her bed telling me, I'm going to beat this, you know, I'm going to beat this. And actually having the, well, you know, let's tuck you into bed and think about what dying will be like was obviously not the right conversation to have with her. We needed to talk about her hopes for the future. And it was heartbreaking because I could see what was happening to her. The nurses could see what was happening to her. Her husband could see what was happening to her. But she needed to be in a different place in her mind in order to deal calmly with what was happening.
Right.
And I almost wonder whether on one level she knew what was going on and this masquerade was a distraction in order not to have to go and sit with that reality.
Right. And that's just what she needed.
And that was what she needed, and that was what we did for her.
Mm. So it sounds like for you, a good death is a death where someone is prepared and someone gets to say the right things that they want to say to their loved ones.
I guess a good death really is the death that people get to do on their own terms, isn't it?
Right.
So for most people, it turns out that knowing about it is empowering. Mm-hmm. Understanding what's going on is empowering. And then being able to decide who will visit, who you want to have around the bed at the time, who you definitely don't want to have, mm-hmm. where you might like to be, whether the dog is in the bed, under the bed, or right. out in the garden. These are all really important things to people.
So again, it's like with birth, where you're meant to draw up a birth plan, you should draw up a death plan. Should you draw up a death plan? Is that me trying to organise? I'm thinking I should write a death plan already. I mean,
well, there's a thing that's happening in the NHS where we're trying to encourage people to plan in advance some of the things that are plannable, mm-hmm. in terms of place. You know, if I could die anywhere at all and be properly looked after, where would I like to be? Mm-hmm. And most people, if you ask them when, you know, they're hale and hearty like you and I are, say, well, you know, I'd like to be in my bed. I'd like a nice red wine in one hand, and I'd like my children and my spouse beside me, or whatever is your ideal scenario. But what happens when we're very ill is that our priorities seem to change. And even the priority for staying alive, interestingly, seems to change. And that brings us back to your mum, really, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Who changed her priorities at the point when she lost her mobility.
Yeah.
So she clearly had some ideas about what was acceptable,
yes.
and what was beyond acceptable for her.
Yeah. So as a family member or a friend, how do you know what to talk about? Can you make general rules, or is it just feeling based on that particular death?
I think one of the difficulties we have is that when we know that somebody has got a really serious illness, we go all touchy-feely on them, and we actually change the relationship that we've always had with them. So I guess what I would like, if you were my pal coming to see me, would be to say, so what do you want us to talk about today? And I might just want to talk about that darts match that you cheated in, and you know you cheated, and it's 10 years, and you've still never admitted that you cheated. Or actually, you might be the person who visits on the day when I need to say, who is going to look after my children?
Mm.
And it's really interesting who people choose to talk to, because it's not always their nearest and dearest, because they know those conversations might make people that they love sad.
Mm.
And very often, for example, if we've had the conversation about what dying is likely to be like, I will finish that conversation by explaining that at the very, very end of life, what your family will see if they're with you is that you are deeply unconscious. So we can't stop it from being sad for your family, but they're not going to see something terrible. They're not going to see something horrible or frightening. And in a way, seeing somebody die in that peaceful, almost predictable way is a thing that enables families to be less fearful about their own deaths and about each other's deaths. So it's an absolutely fantastic last gift to give.